Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It's a special program where we get to talk about one of the original 14 APFA teams that turned into the NFL. And we have that opportunity today when we talk to historian Bruce Smith, who had a podcast on the Dayton Triangles, as he tells us the history of his city of Dayton and the Triangles, coming up in a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. In our series on early pro football teams, we have one of the biggies, one of the original 14 APFA teams. Remember, the APFA lasted for 2 years, and then it changed into the National Football League back in the early 1920s. And we have a gentleman here that had a podcast devoted to totally one of these teams, the Dayton Triangles. And Bruce Smith, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, Bruce, you're calling us from out west. What's your background and your association that makes you like the Dayton Triangles?
I grew up near Triangle Park. And I found out later in my life that Dayton had had an NFL original team. And I was fascinated by this. And eventually I wanted to find out more about the team and how it came to be, who the important people were. And I knew that this little stretch of land was called Triangle Park. And I knew there was a Triangles. And I wanted to know how the names originated. As it turns out, neither the team nor the park are named after each other. They're both named after a group of three companies that were very prominent in the Dayton area in the early 1900s. And so they were called the Triangle Companies. And they set up this they actually set up the park originally for their employees and eventually for the entire city population. And so the team sort of grew out of that. It originated with a group of kids back in the 1910s who played football under the name St. Mary's Cadets. And they formed the basis, the nucleus of what became the Triangles, along with players from the other Triangle Company teams.
Oh, you know, that has such a familiar story as we were studying, you know, these early pro teams. You have these sandlot teams of, you know, young kids getting together and playing in their local neighborhood, you know, named after the street or the, you know, the park that they're playing in, such as the Triangles. And then they grow up to be a semi-pro team and then a pro team. Very, very interesting indeed. Now, who were some of the young players that may have evolved with the team and took it into the professional level?
For diehard fans of the NFL from the early days, probably the most memorable person was a fellow named Norbert Sackstetter. Sackstetter was a journeyman who played for several years in the early NFL. He started out with the St. Mary's Cadets, became a Dayton Triangle, but he also signed with other teams. He was one of those original free agents who signed with different teams at various points in time. In fact, Saxtetter was a member of the 1923 Canton Bulldogs, who were the first champion of the National Football League. So, you know, he's got a long history in terms of the early game. Another guy was a fellow named Alphonse Mart, or Al Mart. Some people called him Marty. And he was an amazing quarterback. People compared him favorably with guys like Sammy Baugh when Sammy Baugh came up, because he had such a great arm. The guy, he was a small guy, very slight, probably in his adult years weighed 160 pounds soaking wet. But they say he could sling a football like he wouldn't believe. Newspaper writers described his passes as coming out like gunshots because he had so much on the ball. And this wasn't the modern football. This was basically a rugby ball, like a watermelon in terms of the size, and yet he could fling it around all over the place. Really, really great guy. The first coach of the team was a fellow named Nelson Talbot, also known as Bud. And he basically got involved because his father was the head of one of the three Triangle companies, Dayton Metal Products Company. His father, Harold Talbot, who was also known as the Colonel. And so Nelson Talbot had been a star end for Yale back in 1912, 13, 14. And he was from Dayton. He came back to Dayton and he had this idea of wanting to, you know, coach this team. And it was something that actually I think he had been planning to do for several years. And he would have probably done it longer, except his father unfortunately passed away suddenly. And so Nelson had to become more involved with the family business. And that was one of the things that caused the Dayton Triangles to eventually decline, because Talbot was a great football tactician. He was a great coach. He was really into preparation. He got his players into doing things like using tackling dummies, which back in 1922 was almost unheard of. But he did that. He was into it. He was very forward-thinking in terms of his approach to the game. Back before 1920, Nelson Talbot had given an interview where he proposed, you know, forming a league. Of course, the Triangles played in what was called the Ohio League, but it wasn't really a league as we know them now. It was just a loose collection of teams that got together and played for bragging rights. And Nelson Talbot was trying to get the teams to come together and form a league, which eventually they did in 1920. So another one of the key players was a guy named Lou Partlow, who was a great running back. He was kind of the counter to Saxtetter. Saxtetter was a guy who tried to make you miss. Partlow was a guy who tried to run you over. And so between the two of them, they had sort of maybe one of the first great 1-2 punch combinations in terms of running backs in the National Football League.
A little bit of a thunder and lightning.
Thunder and lightning, yes. Except with Saxtetter, it was more like he was more like a Barry Sanders kind of runner. Saxtetter didn't use a stiff arm. He basically would try to run around you. He would run up to you and stop. And then when you tried to tackle him, he would move the other way, or he would just blow by you when the tackler thought that he was going to stop. He was about not getting hit. Partlow was all about hitting. So, yeah, that thunder and lightning thing.
Now, that's extremely interesting. Now, I guess I'd be a little bit remiss. You mentioned the three companies, and we talked about the one, the Dayton,
Metal Products.
Yeah. What were the other two companies by chance?
The other two, the best known of the two was the Dayton Engineering Laboratories Company, better known by Delco. Ah. If you've ever dealt with Delco batteries or things like that, that's where that came from. And that started when a fellow named Edward Deeds hired a guy named Charles Kettering to solve a problem with cash registers, because Deeds worked for the National Cash Register Company in Dayton. And they wanted to figure out a way, because you had to, the cash registers of the day had like a big one-armed bandit that you had to pull. It was very difficult physically. So Deeds hired Kettering to put an electric motor in the cash register. And it really took off. After that, Deeds and Kettering got together, and they developed a means of starting cars with the same technology, the electric starter, which is now ubiquitous in automobiles.
Right.
And so they started the Delco to market those electric starters. And then the second company was called Domestic Engineering Company. And that grew out of a project that Deeds had been involved in early in his career, where he had electrified all of NCR's various manufacturing plants worldwide. They realized that they could take this technology and scale it down to a smaller size for things like farms and homes and small communities that were outside the electric power grids of the day. This was like 20 or 30 years before Franklin D. Roosevelt came along with the whole rural electrification thing. So there was no rural electrification. So if you wanted electricity on your farm, power and light, they came up with this generating system, which they called Delco Light, and which they eventually spun off into this Domestic Engineering Company. So the three companies were Delco, Domestic Engineering, and Dayton Metal Products.
Wow. Okay. And that forms a triangle, and they had the community park for their employees. And
yes.
Wow. Very, very interesting. Great history there that you shared with us. Thank you for that. Now, the Dayton, you're talking about the mythical Ohio League, and Dayton is sort of a ways away from the rest of the teams. Cause when we think of, the Ohio League, Canton and Akron, Cleveland, Massillon, Columbus, and they're sort of geographically in the center, or maybe to the east of Ohio, where Akron is, way down by Cincinnati, basically down by the Kentucky line, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, so, Dayton is about 50 miles north of Cincinnati.
Oh, is it? Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it's quite a long travel, even by today's standards, in the days of the era of, that we're talking about, the early 1920s. So were there other teams on the west side of Ohio that Dayton played against quite a bit?
There was a team in Cincinnati that were called the Celts that they played quite frequently. They also played against teams in Indiana. They also played occasionally, especially in the early NFL days, against a team in Rock Island, Illinois. And they played with the teams over there as the league was starting to expand. But Dayton was the principal team in that part of the Ohio.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So Now we have them playing. How did they have some representation at those famous 1920 late summer meetings in Canton, Ohio?
Yes, in fact, they did. As a matter of fact, their representative was a fellow named Carl Stork. Stork had come up as part of the St. Mary's Cadet Organization, and eventually he became the manager of the Triangles, the business manager, after the original business manager went to World War I in the pre-NFL days. And after that, Stork remained as the business manager. He went on to become an officer of the NFL and, in fact, was the last president of the National Football League prior to the beginning of the commissioner era.
Really? Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Yes, a lot of people have forgotten about Carl Stork, but he played a key role in the National Football League. He advanced a lot of ideas about standardizing the size and shape of the ball, about the creation of the Pro Bowl. He was the one who really insisted that the professional game be the elite American football game. Prior to Stork becoming president, Joe Carr, who was the second president, who had been president for a long time, didn't really pay much attention to having the pro teams beat the college teams when they played their exhibitions. Stork went all in on that and said, the NFL needs to be the elite league of American football.
Okay. So did he have anything to do with the famous college all-star games that Arch Ward started? Did he sell into that or buy into that with Arch Ward?
I'm not sure if he bought into the all-star games. I didn't find that out in a lot of my research. What I was talking about specifically were the NFL teams used to play exhibitions against the top college teams. And the college teams, up until about 1940, usually won those games because the National Football League teams didn't really take them seriously. They took them like exhibition games, whereas the college players were sort of out to prove that they were better than these professionals. Up until about 1940, professional football players were regarded as hacks in many cases, or just mere mercenaries, whereas the college players played for the love of the game.
Okay, I understand now. All right. Yeah, I see that quite a bit where, end of the season, like when Frankfurt and the Pottsville scandal happened, I think that was over them playing a Notre Dame team of all-stars. I think that sort of what that scandal in the mid 1920s happened over, why Pottsville ended up losing their NFL title. So must be one of those kind of games that you're referring to.
Well, yeah, actually this was later on. The league, the NFL, didn't allow teams to scrimmage with other teams as they were preparing for games. And Stork was the guy who said, we need to give our teams every opportunity to beat the college teams in exhibitions. He said, we need to take this more seriously because we want the NFL to be the elite American football league instead of one of the college conferences.
Okay, so it was like the NFL preseason was against the college teams, what you're saying?
Yeah, they used to play in the preseason against college teams.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, very, very interesting. Okay, so how did Dayton perform in these early APFA seasons?
The first couple of seasons, they were very competitive. In 1920, They were undefeated going into the last month of the season. They had had probably their most memorable game at this point was a tie with the Canton Bulldogs when Jim Thorpe came to town for the first time. Thorpe had to kick a couple of field goals late in the game to salvage the tie, or else Dayton would have won. That was sort of their moment. That was, you know, they proved once and for all that they deserved to play with all those big teams, the Cantons and the Massillons and the various other ones, the Columbus Panhandles, who they beat in the first NFL game that season. So it was a lot of affirmation for them that, you know, they belonged in this big league. They ended up losing two tough games at the end of the season to Akron, who became the initial APFA champion after that. So after that first couple of years, though, things sort of went downhill. Nelson Talbot, who was the original coach, had to step aside to take more interest in the family business after his father had died. And one of the unsung heroes, a fellow named Forrest Burley McNabb, F.B. McNabb, who was a big supporter of the team and was on the original Triangle Park Association board that pushed the team and allowed them to lose a lot of money over the first years of the team's existence. Unfortunately, passed away at a very young age due to kidney disease. And after those two were out of the scene, the people running the Triangle companies were no longer interested in the Triangles. They withdrew their support. And Carl Stork actually became the owner of the team. He actually owned the franchise until it was sold in 1929. And after that, you had the quality of play was going up. The Triangles couldn't keep up. And eventually they became what I call breathers. Basically a team that other teams scheduled to have an easy game on the schedule, because they weren't very good in their last years. I think they lost like 17 or 18 games in a row over the course of two or three seasons.
Oh, my goodness. So was 1929, was that their last season, or did they go on beyond that?
They were sold in 1929 to a guy in New York who took the team and renamed them the Brooklyn Dodgers. And they continued to play for many years after that. As a matter of fact, there's a guy out there named Bob Carroll, I think, who has documented the entire series of events that led to a piece of the Dayton Triangle still existing as today's Indianapolis Colts.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with Mr. Carroll's work in the PFRA writing, so... Yeah, very, very nice. I'll have to check that out and look more into that. So, okay. So basically the Triangles, by what you're saying, Mr. Carroll said, they're back in the, that Indianapolis, Western Ohio area as the, Indianapolis Colts. So very interesting to tell things go full circle. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I certainly appreciate you coming on here and sharing the story of these Dayton Triangles, your hometown team that you've became so fond of and did so much research on, and a great podcast. Maybe if you could you share your YouTube channel where your podcasts are stored nowadays?
Sure. Actually, there's a website, DaytonTrianglesPodcast.com, and that has links to all of the episodes. And each episode is linked so you can go one by one. There's also a YouTube playlist, and I can send you that link.
Okay.
Where you can basically run down the entire series of podcast episodes. There are 20 in all, covering the basically from the very beginning around 1905 when the forward pass came into the game until basically the last part of through 1929. And also there's sort of a little epilogue chapter that talks about the time that Carl Stork became president of the NFL for a couple of seasons and his tragic end.
Ah, okay. Well, we'll look forward to looking into that. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you are have another hobby that I've become involved with you a little bit here. You're a musician. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I've been a musician for a long time. I had a career in IT. I'm retired now. But a few years ago, I started creating stock music for media productions. My work has been used in productions from NPR and has also been used by National Geographic. And it's been a lot of fun to do. And I actually put together something on the podcast that was sort of a little piano rag piece of music that I used to kind of take in and out and kind of loop through at various points. And you had contacted me initially about using that. So I expanded it into a longer, a slightly longer form piece so that you could do that. And it's out there available at Pond 5 if anybody wants to license it. Absolutely, you can.
Yeah, we have a big project here, Sports History Network, and that's what I contacted you about. And we are going to be using that. So probably the first quarter of 2022, we will have our podcast drama. We'll talk more about that on some later episodes and get everybody introduced to it, because we're still in the early stages of getting actors. But it is very sports history oriented. And it's going to tell some great history in a drama series. So listeners, look forward to that. And you can hear the great music of Bruce Smith and his collections of some of his music that he's shared with us to use on that. So we're very thankful for that. And thankful that you could come on and join us today to tell us about the Dayton Triangles, Bruce. Thank you very much.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks, Darren.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.